You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Gary Giddens returns to the show this week, a renowned jazz historian, film scholar, and the author of many books, including one of my favorite film books, Warning Shadows, Home Alone with Classic Cinema. Almost 20 years ago, he published Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams, The Early Years, 1903 to 1940. That book was a brilliant portrait of the rise of one of the greatest entertainers of the 20th century. And now, at long last, comes the second volume, Bing Crosby, Swinging on a Star, The War Years, 1940 to 1946. It focuses on the pivotal years of the century as well as the career of Bing Crosby. Gary Giddens, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So when did you realize that this book, which is of equal length to your first volume, would only cover 6 years?
Well, after the first volume came out, Mrs. Crosby read it, and I hadn't spoken with her before then, but she invited me out to the house. And when I saw the materials there, I mean, Bing was something of a pack rat, and there were thousands of letters, different kinds of correspondence, and I was completely overwhelmed by the number of letters that came from soldiers and from parents and siblings and lovers and so forth of soldiers who had been killed and in their grief wrote letters to Crosby. And the quantity of them alone was astonishing, but they were so moving I found myself tearing up reading some of them. And Mrs. Crosby had the same reaction. I don't think she had looked at many of these letters. And the more research I did, the more I realized that, you know, Crosby's work during the war was an astonishing thing, which he never spoke about. It's not even mentioned in Call Me Lucky. He was very modest about it. He didn't think he deserved any kind of praise. And it was a story that really hadn't been told. And suddenly I found myself with a voluminous amount of materials to work from. And then in addition, the 40s is clearly the great period in his career. It's the Father O'Malley era. It's the period of some of his most famous songs, including White Christmas and Swinging on a Star. It's been a long, long time and so forth. So I went back to Little Brown and I said I want to do a book about the home front, the war, because nobody had ever done a book about the war in terms of the home front and from the perspective of a USO performer.
Given the fact that he was so pathologically modest, were you surprised that he had kept so much stuff?
I the whole experience was a surprise, yes. And then it got, you know, as I say in the book, it got even better because a year or so later, I can't remember exactly the timeline, but Robert Bader, who was working for the Crosby estate, said that there was a storage locker somewhere, I think in Nevada, that had cartons and cartons and cartons of correspondence and business letters and so forth, and that as they were vetted by the Crosby estate, they would allow me to see them. And so suddenly I had so many different ways to approach the subject. I had the personal correspondence, but I also had dictatape, dictabelt, I forget what they're called, but recordings in Crosby's own voice, which were later transcribed as correspondence. And I had all the business dealings, and there were aspects of that that I really did not expect. I had heard rumors, for example, that Going My Way was fought tooth and nail by Paramount, that everybody thought the film would destroy Crosby's career. But now I was beyond rumor. I had it in writing, and so it is always very, very exciting.
And it's a fabulous book. I'm so happy that you wrote it. But all of the people who admire Bing Crosby and admire your work also want me to ask, do we have to wait 18 years for Volume 3, Gary?
Well, that would be rough. I'm 70 now. The research is basically done, but there's no...
That's what Robert Caro says.
Right. But there's no contract, and so it really depends on how this book does. And if they ask me for the third volume, no, it won't take 18 years, but it would take a couple. and at the very least. And I mean, this book was actually finished the first January 5th, 2017, thinking that it would come out late that year. But the post production, if you call it that, was a year and a half. So it's, you know, getting permissions on photographs and copy editing and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a process.
Are you still, I mean, do you still feel an interest in writing more about Bing?
I think the last volume, there's some great things in it. I mean, I have a lot on high society. There's some great stories there. And the film White Christmas, and he made one of my favorite recordings of all time, Bing with the Beat. I think that was 1958. I can't say I'm as interested in you know, I wouldn't feel that I had to do the kind of detail work that I did in this volume. At this point, not every film, I think, would have to be gone over in detail. And, you know, the recordings are hit and miss. And then really, after the mid-50s, his career was primarily in television specials. There were no more touring. You know, he never did the USO thing like Bob Hope did it his whole life. Bing never did that again after the war. And so I think in some ways it would be an easier work to deal with. But I'm certainly not bored with him. I've been living with him for all these years, and I find him really fascinating. And you know, I wouldn't want it to be a son in that first family, but I find him extremely admirable, and I think he was courageous during the war. And as a professional, nobody speaks a bad word about him. None of the performers, none of the jazz musicians, none of the actors. You know, Jane Wyman, one of the first people I interviewed, said he was the best leading man she ever worked with, and I heard that from almost everyone, male and female, who worked with him.
Right. So a lot of the books that were written right after Bing's death in 1977 were extremely unflattering, and they painted a picture of a man who was cold, and I think A Hollow Man was the subtitle of one of the terrible books.
Well, The Hollow Man was really a disgrace. I mean, I benefited from it because their primary source was Al Rinker, and Al Rinker was furious. He thought he'd been completely misrepresented and misquoted, so he sat down to write his own journal, and he passed away before I started on the book, but his daughter and his widow allowed me access to all of that. So that having Rinker in his own words was an extraordinary thing. But, you know, I have to say, when I wrote the proposal for this book, I believed the basic idea of Hollow Man. I didn't know anything else. And that sort of fascinated me, the way a man could be the soul of warmth in his professional life and be cold and remote and unavailable in a human way in his private life. But then as I started doing interviews, there was a filmmaker in California who was doing a documentary on Crosby for Disney. And we were sharing information, and one night I called him from my hotel out there, and I said, am I talking to the wrong people? Because he's coming off saintly in almost every interview I've done. And he said, I've been thinking the same thing. And ultimately, you have to go with your research. I mean, I don't hedge any bets in this book. I talk about exactly what went on inside the house to the degree I could get it, and I think I got more actual material than anyone else ever has, having interviewed two of the sons and the widows of the other two. So, you know, I don't make apologies. I think there's more nuance there than had been before. But one of my primary interviews was Gary Crosby. I have something like 9 hours of him on tape, and I took him through the book, and you know, he rescinded quite a lot, and a lot of it he didn't even know how it got into the book. I mean, he would say, well, I was drinking then, I don't know. And I'd say, but Gary, this is what destroyed your father's reputation. And he said, but this book is not about my father. It's going my own way. It's about me. And then I realized that very few people ever read Gary's book, but everybody heard about it. That's where the damage was done, because if you actually read the book, it's not nearly as damning after the first chapter. And the first chapter was not done by Gary. It was done by the publishers to get a sale to the National Enquirer. And so they overloaded all this red-blooded stuff, a lot of which was nonsense. So, again, not apologizing. He definitely believed in corporal punishment. He definitely insulted Gary over his weight and hit him with a strap that he boasts about and called me lucky. But on the other hand, he also came to admit in the mid-50s, long before Gary's book, that that was a mistake. And, of course, he didn't make that mistake again in the second family. The three children from that family all venerate him. So, you know, he's certainly not a monster.
Well, that's good to know. I want to ask you about another aspect of your book that you spend quite a bit of time talking about that's controversial today, and that is blackface. Recently, an NBC newscaster was fired from her well-paying job for talking about blackface. So we have to be careful. We don't want to lose this radio show. But talk a little bit about blackface as it, I mean, how can people perceive it today when they look at Holiday Inn or some of the other, Dixie, for instance, movies not available because of it, right?
Right. Well, as you say, race plays a big role in this book, and Chapter 13 is almost entirely about blackface. It's impossible for us to look at it now and just slough it off, which you basically could do when I was growing up. I mean, every night on television you'd see Al Jolson movies and other Eddie Cantor, and people just accepted it as part of that period. I don't think we should censor it. I don't think we should ever do it again, but I think people should know what the history is. I think people should understand that during World War II, when we were fighting dictators who were screaming racial exceptionalism, that minstrelsy and blackface had its biggest comeback, biggest revival in American culture since the 19th century. So what was that about? And if you read the comments about it in Life magazine and other places, it's all, it's an American art form, minstrelsy, and it's continuity with our fathers and grandfathers, and everybody's very, very proud of it. And I think it's historically fascinating that when Holiday Inn came out, except for Kate Cameron in the New York Herald Tribune, who singled out White Christmas, none of the other major reviewers, most of them didn't even mention White Christmas. They all thought the hit of the movie was going to be the blackface number, Abraham. And they weren't being racist. That's the way they responded to it. Berlin himself at one point said, we can't push White Christmas in August when the film was opening. The big hit's going to be Abraham, the swinging spiritual, as he called it. So, you know, it's a different time. I quote in the book, and I frequently when I speak, I use this wonderful line from the historian Paul Fussell, who wrote about the wars. And Fussell says, if you really want to understand the past, you have to forget that you know the present. And you have to try to look at it from the perspective. And most of the performers, including Crosby, including Donald O'Connor, who was an absolutely lovely man, least racialist person you can imagine, who grew up doing blackface, it was a theatrical convention by the time they got to it. It was sort of fun to be invisible on stage. Bob Hope told me the first time he worked in the East, I think he was emceeing in New Jersey, and he was scared to death. He was a young, you know, huffer. And when he walked off stage, an old-timer said, Bob, the next time you do it, come out in blackface. And he said, and it worked, because I was anonymous. Nobody could see me. And suddenly I became very secure. And O'Connor said that a lot of performers had that perspective. I mean, we look at it now from a completely different place. We know more about the history. We understand the stereotyping and all of the negativity that's attached to it. But you have to remember that in the 1940s, when blackface was having its revival, the black newspapers, the NAACP, they went, you know, ballistic, rightfully so, when Irving Berlin used the word darky in one of the songs, and he apologized and they took it out. But nobody complained about blackface. I mean, I could not find a single example in a black African-American newspaper of the war period. And why? Because so many black performers were still doing it. It had become that much of a convention. In fact, if you look at the all-black film Stormy Weather, you can see two legendary black comedians backstage chatting with each other while they put the cork on their faces.
So tell us a little bit about the difference then between appropriation and influence.
Well, that's the interesting question. You know, I think somebody did a book about it called Love and Theft. The influence is just beyond dispute. People saw black dancers, amateurs, singers on the street, white performers, and they took it and they imitated it, and they thought it would be funny. It would be more easily accepted if they pretended that they were Negroes. In fact, when Wendell Willkie and Walter White of the NAACP went out to Hollywood to demand better jobs before and in back of the camera, they didn't have any problem with blackface. I mean, they thought it was very sort of funny in a way. If white folks want to pretend that they're black, you know, God bless them. But all we want is real jobs. We want to stop playing maids and morons and, you know, shoeshine men. So in that period, it still has that conventional quality. But there's no question that Crosby did a film called The Birth of the Blues, which is thematically precisely about the fact that blacks brought this music, this blue music. They never call it jazz or swing. They call it blues music, which was Albert Murray's favorite phrase. And all these white people heard it, and they took it. But when they took it, I mean, Louis Armstrong loved that fact because it meant that it wasn't a folk music. It was an international music. It was a music of the greatest profundity. And it would take over the whole world. And the more people who devoted their lives to it, the better that was. So it's an interesting place to go because, you know, in the 40s, really until the 50s, until the middle 50s, it was almost unheard of. For example, for a black professor to be at a white university teaching white students. The first black professors who were teaching, who whites came to, were mostly in jazz, and you know the Lenox School that John Lewis helped to found, and the movie The Birth of the Blues is basically about the idea that all these young white musicians who want to be jazz musicians, they're the acolytes of the black musicians. Now, do they show us great black musicians in the film? No, they only go up to a certain place, and then they sort of back off because it's the time. But there's no way to read that movie without knowing what they're basically saying. You know, at one point, somebody says to the Crosby character something about your blues music, and he said, "This isn't my music. This is the whole world's music." And then they show a montage of clips in which you see, Ellington and Paul Whiteman and black and white bands saying that this is American. This is the American style. What I find fascinating, when after Dixie opened, which is the movie about Dan Emmett, the man who created group minstrelsy in theaters on the New York's Bowery, is that so many critics said minstrelsy is the one great art form of American culture. And, there's a lot to be said about this subject. Just to close your eyes to it and walk out of the theater and refuse to see it, I think it's a mistake. This is part of our history. We better deal with it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Gary Giddens. He's the author of Bing Crosby, Swinging on a Star, The War Years, 1940 to 1946. Let's talk a little bit about Bing as a recording artist. One of my favorite songs of Frank Sinatra's is The Summer Wind. And his phrasing is so brilliant on that song. And I recently found a disc of sessions, Summer Wind sessions. And when he comes in and first sings it, he does it about 15 or 20 times before he finds the phrasing that became so great on the final recording. But with Bing Crosby, in your book, it seems like he doesn't ever do more than a couple of takes on something.
Well, one of the things that Vic Shane, who did a lot of the arrangements for him, pointed out is that he did, and actually quite a number of actors also told me, he came so well prepared. I mean, he pretended like it was all just natural and, You know, he hardly ever looked at the script, but he had an extremely retentive memory, and he really worked hard. I'll give you an example. He did a movie called Riding High in the early 50s for Frank Capra, and Clarence Muse, a great African-American actor, was in it, and they do a musical number together in which Bing is supposed to play the spoons, and Clarence Muse is supposed to be twanging a guitar. Now, neither of them knew how to do that, but Bing went out and hired, like, the greatest spoons player in the world, put him up at home, spent hours perfecting it so that when he walked on the set, he was killing with those spoons. But Clarence Muse, he just, you know, pretended to strum the guitar. The problem was every time Capra went in for an insert, a close-up, it was obvious that Clarence wasn't really playing the guitar. Now, here's where it gets really racially so insane that it's almost impossible to even, you know, describe. You'd think that what they would do is then get a black guitarist and shoot him for the close-ups. No, they hired a white guitarist and blacked up his fingers. I mean, can you believe that?
That's great.
So, but the point, the original point I was trying to make here is that Crosby was always extremely well-prepared. So when he walked into the studio, sometimes he would see the song at the studio and he would go over it a couple of times. But he basically knew what his approach was. I talk about his great recording from 1940 or 41 of A Sweetheart of Sigma Chi, which I think is a masterpiece. It's a dreadful, sentimental frat song from the early years of the 20th century, and Bing turns it into an art song. He sings it with so much feeling. I've spoken to a couple of opera people in the opera world who singled that record out, how much they loved, how much emotion he brings into it. Now, in that particular instance, Jack Capp, for some reason, saved the first take, which was the tryout take. And it's Bing, without the orchestra, just accompanied by piano and guitar, and he's singing way too fast, no emotion, no feeling, just to get the phrasing exactly the way he wants it, to know where he's going. And then he says, okay, ready, and the orchestra comes in, and he just nails it. I mean, every syllable of every word is tuned. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's already figured that out once he has the intervals. And then the other thing about Crosby that is impossible to overemphasize, and musicians, oh, this is the first thing they always said to me, his time was infallible. He really understood what Louis Armstrong was about in swing. And, all he listened to, as he once said, was the first beat, you know, the one of each measure, and he knew exactly where to place it. I mean, Jimmy Heath, the great saxophonist, said to me once, listened to Crosby on the radio a lot, and I said, you were a fan? And he said, well, you know, he was the only guy on the air who had time. So that's where we got the songs. If you think about it, even Sinatra in the 1940s was almost exclusively a ballad singer. He made three up-tempo tunes in the decade. Later on, he figured out how to, you know, his own approach to swing, his great comeback. But Crosby, just no matter what he sang, even if it's a Christmas carol, even if it's, you know, Adeste Fidelis, his time is just infallible.
It's also interesting, the recordings versus his live radio versions. You were talking about in the book, the song San Fernando Valley, and it's a lovely record, but then I went and found the recording you talked about on the Kraft Music Hall, and it's so much better.
It is better. There's a lot of that, and I don't know what the problem is. I guess there's some legal issue about radio. A lot of these recordings have been put out, but the legality is somewhat dubious. But the thing is, Bing was at his best on the radio show, and you know, this often happens with recording. You know, Duke Ellington writes a new piece of music. They go into the studio, they rehearse it a couple of times, they make a fantastic recording. The recording becomes a big hit. And then for the next, you know, 6 months, every night he performs it. Well, believe me, at the end of the second or third month, it's much, much better than the thing he recorded. But only people who, you know, if there's some live recordings, that proves the case. But in many instances, only the people who were actually there those evenings would know it. Just as when you go to a play on Broadway, the critics review the first night, but he may be, the stars may be 50 times better 6 weeks later. when they've really gotten into it. And, you know, Crosby would make a, have a hit record, and then he would do it four or five times on Kraft. He would change the arrangements. He would get rid of a lot of the, in some cases, sappy stuff that was on the records. And he would have more fun with it. With a lot of his records, when he did them in the studio, there'd be a kind of, you know, a vocal choir that would be brought in. But when he did them on the air, he'd have the charioteer swinging behind him. So that alone gave him, or the Music Mates for that matter, that gave him a lot more energy. So there's a lot of instances where the radio recordings are superior.
There's a song that, you know, of course we all have our favorites. There's a 78, I don't think it's ever been reissued on a CD, but there's a 78 that I love, which is a song called It Could Happen to You. And you sort of single that song out as one you don't like. What's wrong with that record?
I'd be lying if I said I could remember the details now, but very often, you know, it's a question of is he really embracing the song? Is his breathing right? Is he, you know, sometimes I think he gets everything right, but you just don't feel he's completely engaged. And that may have been what I'm referring to with that one. You know, I give more detail on I'll Be Seeing You, because I'll Be Seeing You was one of his biggest hits. And I think that the radio performance he eventually gave was spectacular. But on the recording, you know, he loses his breath at one point. His phrasing is awkward. There are pauses. Nobody minded that because the song was so perfect for him, and it became a huge hit, and he did it all the time. But if you hear him on the radio performance a few weeks later, there's that authority that I think is missing from the record. Now, it's very, I suggest that the lack of authority may have actually helped sales of the record, because in a way it makes him sound more tremulous and more emotionally involved with the meaning of the song, even though the performance isn't as inspired as it would later be.
His movie acting was definitely different in the 40s than it had been in those earlier pictures.
That's right.
He became a better actor?
He sure did. He sure did. And he was, you know, he was getting frustrated by 1940 at playing the same, you know, characters, and as I point out, he wasn't the kind of actor like, name any other movie star you want, who would appear in certain kinds of movies, that they would read the script and they would, you know, accept the film and do the best that they could. Crosby's pictures were vehicles for him. They didn't exist otherwise. They were just we have to have eight songs or whatever it is, and there'll be a romance and in and out, and because people went to hear that. That began to change with the Bob Hope series, the Road Pictures, where he really got to be funny and where they killed all the sentimentality that was in a lot of the crooner pictures. And then Leo McCarey just, you know, really gave him a difficult role, which he completely embraced, and as Reese Stevens said, she said, "I come from opera. We know about preparation, but you never saw any performer prepare the way Bing did. He was in the part all the time, and the only direction he would get from McCarey is if he came to seem a little pious, and McCarey would say, no, I want to see Bing as the priest. I don't want, you know, the piety." And he gave a performance that's really irresistible. I don't think it's dated in the least bit.
And is that true in the Bells of St. Mary's as well?
Yes, in some ways even more. It's a more difficult performance because he's playing after the most beautiful woman in the world, and they have to both pretend that there's not the slightest erotic tingle between them, which, you know, Crosby later conceded there was. But you know, that was a movie that the censors really were looking at, and I don't know how they did McCarey and Crosby, well, because of who they were, how they got away with some of that. I mean, the mother of the girl that Bing helps to achieve success at the school is basically a prostitute, and as Mary Gordon, the novelist, when she wrote about the O'Malley characters, she said, and Father O'Malley doesn't attempt to get her to change her profession. Nor is he in the least bit shocked or astounded. And I don't think any other actor or director would have even tried to get away with that. And in going my way, I mean, he is a miracle man. He turns a bunch of, you know, creepy, in some respect, juvenile delinquents into this angelic choir. He, a potential streetwalker, he catches and does an intervention, and she becomes a, you know, loving wife. He turns the old realtor, who's just all greed, into a philanthropist. So there's all of this going on. But the thing is, it's about priests. But there's no prayer. There is no prayer in Going My Way, not once. Every time that they need an intervention, they get it through song. Bing writes a song, or somebody sings a song, and the song brings investors, or people give money to the church. But it's the least pious of religious movies, and Crosby loved it not least because, having taken the romance away from the character, it gave him a lot more sense of control on the set. He didn't feel like he was playing a character, not just himself, but a character that he recognized in himself. And there's a wit in his performance that I think is remarkable, and just a complete authority. I mean, from the moment he arrives and he says good morning, and you see him on the stairs, and he can't find the church, which is an interesting beginning, you just see that, you know, he's never been quite a priest like this character or any other actor who could have played him. And it's interesting the way, you know, the movie is so brilliantly structured by McCary. So much of it's improvised. But in the opening scene, there's no comity between the people who live in this on the Upper West Side in New York, where the church is. They're all hating each other and screaming at each other and making jokes about each other. And then at the end, after the church has been destroyed in a fire, and they're sitting in the rubble of the kind of scene you'd see in a documentary about war-torn Europe, they are now a community. And so I think it's a deeper film. A lot of people remember it as being sentimental and just sort of over-the-top tearjerker, because, yes, you cry at the end, but you also cry at the end of Chaplin's City Lights, and people forget how funny the film is. I have to say, I did not realize that the film is a comedy until I saw it play at the theater at Lincoln Center in a, you know, full-capacity audience. And the laughter was practically nonstop for the first hour and a half. When you're sitting at home, sometimes you don't plug into the humor quite that way.
Well, there is a really Hal Roach-esque scene in the beginning when Bing gets
the sprinkles, yeah. the street sprinkler. Well, McCary actually originally created that scene for Laurel and Hardy. And, you know, you compare the two, the Laurel and Hardy film and Going My Way, and it's basically the same thing, but it's so much, it's funnier and weirder when it's a priest who's he's kneeling to get a baseball that's been chucked under a car, and a street sprinkler comes up and soaks him. And this, of course, it becomes important to the plot, because now he has to get out of his priest uniform. And so when Father Fitzgibbon and the people in the church first see him, he's wearing a St. Louis Browns jacket, and he doesn't look in the least bit priestly.
Sweatpants or something, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we return now to our conversation with Gary Giddens. He's the author of Bing Crosby, Swinging on a Star, The War Years, 1940 to 1946. There's a movie that's beyond the scope of your book, and that's The Country Girl. I think that's probably the most remarkable performance he ever gave on film. You want to talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, it is an extraordinary performance. When towards the end of the war, Paramount offered to buy him Harvey, which was the biggest hit on Broadway at the time, and he turned it down because he didn't want his sons to see him playing an alcoholic. Well, big mistake. He didn't make that mistake when he was offered The Country Girl. The director who went to him, George Seaton, everybody said, you can't do that. His wife's an alcoholic. Bing had a drinking problem. It's going to be very touchy. But as soon as Bing read the play, he signed on. And he's really steals the film. I mean, Grace Kelly got it. Rosemary Clooney said, if you if you're a beautiful woman and you wipe out off all your makeup and wear a ratty old sweater, you get an Oscar. And I think that sort of describes Grace Kelly's luck there. But Bing gives an extraordinary performance. Two actors told me they were studying at with Strasberg in New York at the Actors Studio in 1954, and everybody was talking about the performance Marlon Brando was giving that year in Going on the Waterfront. And Strasberg said, "I know everybody's talking about Brando, but please go to see A Country Girl and see what Crosby does with close-ups." And it's really amazing. Those close-ups, there is so much, you can just read everything in his face that hasn't been written down. And the scenes where he changes, you know, on a dime between being terrified and griping and just angry and furious with himself and everyone else. And then two women in the play come over to say hello, and he's the picture of charm. It really is quite an extraordinary performance. I've seen it, other productions of it on stage, and I've never seen anyone come close to what Crosby does with that part.
It seems like it was written for him, but obviously it wasn't.
No, it was written. It was a Broadway show. It was the last big success Clifford Odets ever had.
There's another movie of Bing's that you mention in your book, although it's much later, and I haven't seen it for years, but I have fond memories of Bing's performance, and that's a TV film he did called Dr. Cook's Garden.
That's the one where he plays a serial killer. I don't know why that's never been... It's never shown. I mean, I understand why it's never shown. But I don't understand why it hasn't come out on a DVD or a Blu-ray.
Well, let's ask Robert Bader to put it out for us.
Yeah, somebody should put it out, whoever owns the rights to it, because he plays a doctor in a small community who, whenever his patient's beyond saving, he murders them. And it's really, it's another remarkable performance. He's wearing a full beard in it. And, you know, again, he has to wear two faces throughout the entire production, and he's very good in it. That's probably the last really great piece of acting he did. That and playing the alcoholic doctor in a not very good remake of Stagecoach. I have to say, you know, Gordon Douglas directed that. And I interviewed him, and I said, how did it feel to be remaking a classic by John Ford? And I won't repeat the language he used, but basically he said, are you out of your mind? Are you crazy? You can't remake a John Ford movie. All we did is try to tell the same story.
Right, and why bother? Because, you know, the original is
well, good. Yeah.
And something that's interesting in that is that Bing plays the part that Thomas Mitchell had played.
That's right.
And Thomas Mitchell... in one of his stage roles, originated the part of Columbo in Prescription Murder on stage. And when they were doing the Columbo television series, they considered Bing Crosby.
They offered him the part. They offered him the part. They tailored it for him. They saw him in the trench coat, relaxed, laid back. And fortunately, I think Crosby said he wasn't interested. And, of course, Peter Falk seems to have been made for the part. But, that was an interesting turn. And then when Crosby finally agreed to do a television series, it was the Bing Crosby Show, which was just a bad idea from beginning to end. So that lasted one season. And then the best work he did on TV was really on the Hollywood Palace and some of those variety shows.
Sometimes on those Hollywood Palaces, you can hear Bing doing duets or musical numbers with a wide variety of performers, and he holds his own, you know, with whoever was the performer of the day.
He holds his own with Ella. He loved Ella. He's unbelievable with Armstrong. I mean, the last time they appeared together on Hollywood Palace, I think, is one of the most moving moments I've ever seen on television. They're having so much fun together, and at the end, Bing just puts his arm around, pops his shoulder, and there's this long shot of them walking off the stage. And then I think maybe the best, one of my favorite Bing clips is the 8-minute duet he does with Johnny Mercer, where Bing is at his absolute peak. He's so funny and fast on his feet, and he just goes from song to song to song. It's really quite a performance. I think he's best when he's when he's, you know, has to be spontaneous, and duets really worked for him. Rosemary loved doing duets. Everybody did, because he would do the harder part. He'd do the harmony. He'd let you show up. But he would do things like, you know, ad-lib lines that you weren't expecting, which would make you laugh. And then, you know, when he did an album with Fred Astaire in London in the last couple of years of his life, and Fred was, every word had to be rehearsed and had to be written down, and, you know, Bing wouldn't stand for that, and he changed the line so many times in the studio that Fred just said, oh, the hell with it, and they ended up making a really wonderful recording together in which Fred holds his own improvising along with Bing, but he had to get him to do that, and, you know, I remember Rosemary told me that when they did the first record together for Victor, there was a, I forget what the line was in one of the duets, but it was written out, a little bit of chatter, and he just rewrote his lines without telling her. And, you know, she looked up and realized that this was not, this was a take. You couldn't, you don't have the option to stop the take. So she was, it just loosened her up, and she said it was so much fun, and she couldn't believe how good it came. I mean, they didn't have to do another take on it. So this was one of the things he brought to collaborations. You have to have the temperament for that. Sinatra's brilliant in so many ways, but he was never good at duets in the early years because he was like competing, or he was nervous about who does what where. But this Crosby loved it. And it did tend to shine in that setting.
What was the true feeling that Bing Crosby had about Frank Sinatra? I mean, he jokes, you know, it's a voice that comes along once in a lifetime. Too bad it came along in mine. Well, how did he really feel about Sinatra?
Well, he totally respected him as an artist. I mean, there's no question about that. He knew, maybe before anybody else, that Sinatra was something different. I mean, most every young singer who had come along in the previous 8 to 10 years was imitating Bing on one level or another, and Sinatra was covering all of Bing's songs relentlessly. But even so, he wasn't imitating him, and it wasn't his idea to cover the songs. This is what, you know, Tommy Dorsey forced him to do, and the song publishers in New York. But so he respected that. He did not like Sinatra's his public humiliation of his wife. He was really offended by that. He felt the same way about Hope. He didn't care what you did in private, but he thought it should be private, whereas Frank seemed to like to boast about how many lovers he had out when he went to California. And he also didn't like the fronting for gangsters in Vegas. Bing spent a lot of time in Las Vegas. He loved it, but he would not perform there. He never once performed in a casino. He had certain moral reservations about that kind of thing. But he loved Frank as an artist, and he loved working with him, and they partied together, and they got along well. When they did High Society, you know, Bing thought the highlight of the whole experience was Well Did You Ever. He really enjoyed working with him on that. And I'll tell you one funny story about High Society. John Patrick, who wrote the screenplay, told me that, was it Sam Spiegel who produced it? I think it was. He said, I'm hiring you to write 3 scripts. And he said, the first one's for Sinatra. You have to give Sinatra more lines than the Crosby character. And then they signed Sinatra, and then he had to write a second script where Crosby would get more lines. And then Crosby agreed. And then he said, now go write the script. And I said to him, it was the final script substantially different from the two that they read, the ones they read? And he said, yeah. And he said, but nobody noticed. Nobody ever said a single word to me.
That's funny. Well, you know, there's so much more to talk about, Gary Giddens, but we're just about out of time. And this book is called Bing Crosby, Swinging on a Star, The War Years, 1940 to 1946. It's brilliant.
And thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com.
You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.